I'm Terrence McNally, and welcome to Free Forum, a world that just might work. I'm going to be speaking today with Frances Moore LePay. She's just re-released her first book, The Game-Changing Diet for a Small Planet, in a 50th anniversary edition with a new introduction and a lot of new recipes. The show airs on KPFK 90.7 FM in LA as specials, streams weekly on the Progressive Voices Network on TuneIn. Podcasts are available anytime, anywhere on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, most major podcast sites, and at my site, TerrenceMcNally.net, TerrenceMc, capital NALLY.net. In 1971, the year Diet for a Small Planet was published, I organically farmed a couple of acres with two others in Connecticut off the Long Island Sound. And following the advice of Mother Earth magazine, we turned the soil, collected and spread chicken manure, released ladybugs, and plucked ears off corn stalks and ate them on the spot. We sold our produce by the side of the post road and made a run every day to collect waste from the two nearest grocery stores. The best stuff we ate, and the rest we filled hills of compost. We harvested the final crops in the fall and shared them in a great Thanksgiving feast with our friends at the commune nearby. I stopped eating meat in 1969, reintroduced poultry in the mid-80s, have always eaten some seafood. I eat pretty simply. I minimize ultra-processed stuff when possible. And it's all based as much as anything on personal preference and taste. And my larger perspective, I don't think we're here to care for the environment, but rather to develop and enjoy a healthy relationship with the rest of nature. I bought the book. I carried it with me for years, covered a lot of miles, a lot of different moves, a lot of addresses. It's in my office today. It certainly spoke to me. I'd already given up meat, as I said, but it gave me a context that made it more meaningful, that connected my choices to the bigger picture. And I've been in touch with Frankie over the years. She's joined me here at least a couple of times, usually to talk about democracy more than food. What's exciting to me with the release of the 50th anniversary edition of Diet for a Small Planet is the opportunity to see how they fit together and how they always did. In this new edition, Frances shows us how plant-centered eating can help restore our damaged ecology, address the climate crisis, move us toward real democracy. The impulse to write the book grew out of the same principles as her democracy work and the same question: who's making the decisions? 50 years later, we know that the food system is responsible for 37% of greenhouse gases, cattle alone for 14%. We understand the enormous, costly, and deadly health impacts of diet and obesity. We're aware that ag and food employ more lobbyists than the fossil fuel industry. The book has never been more needed. Frances Moore LePay is the author or co-author of 20 books about world hunger, living democracy, and the environment, beginning with Diet for a Small Planet in 1971. She's the co-founder of Food First and the Small Planet Institute, which she leads with her daughter, Anna LePay. They also co-founded the Small Planet Fund, which channels resources to democratic social movements worldwide. And to learn more about Frankie's work in all of these areas, you can go to dietforasmallplanet.org and democracymovement.us. Welcome again, Frances Moore LePay, to Free Forum, a World That Just Might Work.
Thank you so much. I so appreciate that introduction. I've got a big smile on my face.
Oh, good. Good. And let me tell listeners, we're recording this conversation Friday, October 1st. So I was going to say, any responses to my introduction? Well, we know one of them is a smile. Anything else in terms of how I, because one thing that I think was really clear to me was that this was a chance for you to bring those threads of your life together in one book.
Absolutely. And I had not realized how much you and I actually were part of that same world way back when, and were stimulated by some of the same sort of cultural energy and insights. So that makes me feel even better about talking to you today.
Oh, yes. I mean, as I said, I got that little beat up paperback. Yes, absolutely. And as I followed, your work over the years, it's been clear to me the resonances and the similar paths and so on. Now, I want to ask this question in a way that you may not have been asked before, which is, who wrote that book? Who was that 26-year-old?
Well, a seeker, I think, is the word. I love to tell particularly students that I made a D on my first English paper in college, because that just shows that, you know, if you really have something that you have to share with others, then you'll figure out how to get it out, you know? And so I was a seeker in the sense that I came to adulthood. I left college during the war on poverty, during the time when we thought that we could really do something. It was a different energy than today. I just want to underscore how important that is, to know that that is possible, to be part of a society in which we were asking the biggest questions. And the war on poverty, the great society of Lyndon B. Johnson, that the MO was maximum feasible participation, meant that I, as a warrior in the war on poverty, I went out in the poorest areas of Philadelphia and knocked on doors and worked with African-American women who were victims of slumlords and worked with them to try to buy their own homes with the help of the city government. You know, it was feeling that I was in partnership with government. That's who I was. And unfortunately, the woman I worked most closely with, Lily, died of a heart attack, youngish woman, African-American, and I knew that Lily died of poverty, not of a heart attack, in a sense. And so I ended up, this is an answer to your question, believe me.
Yeah.
So I ended up then out in California. My husband was a postdoc in Berkeley, and I had access to the Berkeley libraries. And I said, wait a minute, Frankie, wait a minute. What was really the cause of Lily's death? That's what you've got to figure out and to go after that. And so at that time, we were being told by Paul Ehrlich at Stanford that, oh, we'd hit the Earth's limits. His book, The Population Bomb, exploded. Mm-hmm. And so I had this intuition that if I could understand why people are hungry in the world, that would unlock the mysteries of economics and politics, and I could get to the root of Lily's untimely death. And so I just sat in the library with a friendly librarian and started saying, is that right? Is that really right that we've hit the Earth's limits? And when I realized that no, humans were actually creating scarcity out of plenty and creating the experience of scarcity for millions and millions, no matter how much we grew. So it was just this aha moment. I had to share it. Terrence, I had to share it. So I started out with a one-page handout.
No, by the way, I love that this book that we're talking about 50 years later began as a one-page handout. I mean, it's like, you know, that the first step.
Yep. And I really did believe that it was great news. It was really good news, because I said, if we humans are creating the problem, then we can end the problem. It's not inevitable that people suffer like this. And so it was sharing great news that we can make this change because we're responsible for the tragedy of needless hunger. And that was my beginning. And I never, ever expected that the book would sell beyond a few hundred copies in the greater Bay Area, maybe. But some other people believed in it, and that's why I dedicate the book, and still do, to Betty Ballantyne, who was one of the founders of paperback publishing in America, and she believed in the ideas.
Wow, I was going to ask that, actually, whether how you worked the publishing industry, but once you had it as a book and got it to this one woman, she saw the possibility.
Well, it wasn't even a book yet. It was really a booklet. And through a friend of mine, Lloyd Linford, he knew her. And somehow, I'm a little fuzzy, but it got into her hands. And she saw its potential. And she actually came out to visit me. I was living in Point Richmond in the Bay Area.
Sure.
She came out to visit me on a trip to visit Paul Ehrlich. And I was so flattered. Oh, you mean you're going to see the Stanford professor and you're coming to see little old me too? And I still remember I made lunch for Betty, And as she parted, she said, "Frankie, whoever publishes your book, I will buy it." Because I had been courted by a local people's sort of press, a very progressive one, who told me that if I published with Ballantyne, the leftover books, they would shred and they would dump them in San Francisco Bay and pollute the bay. So they were trying to convince me not to go with Ballantyne. So I was kind of on the fence until Betty said that to me. And so the recipes were really, really Betty's idea, Betty Ballantyne's idea.
I love it. I mean, and it seems also so distant a way of doing business.
Right.
You know.
In publishing.
Yeah. And a publisher having tips and stuff like that. It's just great. I had a question written down here, but you may have already answered it, which is that how did you have the nerve to do this? And really what I was saying was, where did you find the courage? What you said is that you just needed to get it out there. Anything else you'd want to say about that courage, nerve sort of piece?
Yeah. Well, I never imagined, of course, myself as a writer, and I was terrified. I was actually terrified that maybe I got a decimal point wrong and the whole thesis was wrong.
Oh my God. That's right. But it's based on those figures you came up with in that basement.
It was, by the way, with my dad's slide rule. Now, I know most of the listeners probably don't know what a slide rule is, but I still have my dad's slide rule with the leather case, and that's what I used because there was no electric calculator at that time. And so, but it turned out that the numbers were right, and that there was plenty of potential and there plenty of being produced at the time, and that I learned how we had created the illusion of scarcity, that we were, by feeding so much of our agricultural land, well, today it is 80% of our overall agricultural land goes to feed livestock, that returned to us only 18% of our calories. So we've created this giant protein factory in reverse, as I called it in the first edition. So yeah, it was just, I had to share it. I was terrified, but I just had to share it.
And I'm also guessing that those steps, a one-pager, a booklet, made it a little more possible for you to imagine.
Mm-hmm. You're right. I never thought of it quite like that, but yeah. And that Betty Ballantyne was so enthusiastic and so, yeah.
But I'm thinking for someone who's listening, it starts out as a blog post and then it's, a series of them. And, it's one step after another.
That's right. That's right.
You so also talk about the fact fortunate. That you had fresh eyes.
Yes. One of the things that has been a theme since Diet for a Small Planet is that we humans, have a great brain. Of course, we have great brains. But one very, very special quality about those complex brains is that we see life through filters, through our belief systems, through our experience. And it's very difficult for us often to see what doesn't fit inside these self-created filters. And so I call it... I challenge the idea of seeing is believing, and I flip it around and say, no, believing is seeing. And so if you get schooled in a certain tradition, in a certain discipline, then you don't think about the questions that don't fit in the dominant frame. Whereas I was coming in without training in development economics or nutrition, I was coming in with just square one question, is there enough? Is there enough? And I think all the experts had leapt over that question, and they were going on to theorizing about the assumption of scarcity and that we'd hit the Earth's limit. So I'm a firm believer in the power of fresh eyes. In fact, one of my books a few years ago, we gave an intern a certificate, a prize, a certificate award, I should say, the Fresh Eyes Prize, because he had caught a very serious error in in the drafting of my book, World Hunger, 10 Myths. We had been looking at the data through a false lens about what it was really saying, and he caught it. And so I really do believe that a power of fresh eyes to see what others who have been, you know, narrowed in their vision and taken things for granted don't see, can't see.
Excellent. Yeah, and this whole story is a story of what opens beyond fresh eyes. You had said, I just wanted to lay out one of the calculations, because you gave us the current calculation, which is 80% goes to livestock to provide 18% of calories. And back then, I think when you were doing this research, you found 21 protein calories going into cattle for one calorie of meat. So it's, I think what's happened is it may be slightly more efficient today, but it is so much more overwhelming.
Yes.
So much
yes.
more land has been taken up by it. So many more people now crave the meat diet.
Yes, it is spreading throughout the world as income inequality increases. Meat consumption has gone up. And yes, that ratio is not as extreme, but it is still very extreme. One academic study found that of the feed calories going to livestock in the U.S., we get back 3% from beef. We get back 3% of the calories, and I believe it's 5% of the protein. Anyway, it's very little.
And you say that what you were battling there with those fresh eyes was two nutritional myths. And my guess is that to some listeners, those myths still hold sway.
Yes. And I really think that the idea, first, the myth of scarcity is the foundational false view. And on top of that, then, is the idea that humans need just almost unlimited amounts of protein. And it turns out that most Americans eat twice the protein our bodies can even use, and that we don't use, you know, once we get what we need, then those extra protein calories are used for energy. And so there's no gain in that sense. So that's part of the continuing message to get out.
And the other myth at the time was that the only way to get that those scads of protein that you needed was by eating meat.
Right. And one of the things that people tell me, they say, Frankie, when your book came out, you really helped settle my parents down, because my parents really thought that I would die if I didn't get the protein that I needed from meat. And so you really helped to create family peace. Thank you. And so, yes, that was a very strong view, just an assumption that animal products were the only real source of protein. And now we know that if the scientists all tell us, if we eat a healthy diet of whole foods and a variety of foods, that we do not have to worry at all about getting out of protein.
Yeah, and that's such it just opens up so much. And it's funny, as you talk about parents and children, I certainly remember, and I'm sure you do too, the conversations at so many dinner tables, not just my family, but friends and so on, when you would say, oh, I don't eat meat.
Yes, especially since I grew up in Fort Worth, Texas. Fort Worth, Texas.
Oh my gosh, that is like the center of the stockyards, isn't it?
It is, and the nickname is Cowtown. Cowtown. So it's pretty funny that I took on Cowtown in my life's work.
Yeah.
Yes.
I'm going to read a quote from you, which I think is really kind of sets the sort of perspective on the path over the 50 years since then, which is that you say, very soon after the release of Diet for a Small Planet in 71, I began to summarize my message this way. Hunger is not caused by a scarcity of food, but by a scarcity of democracy, as people are denied power even over life's essentials, and I wanted to focus my readers on power. I have two questions. The first one will just be, let's deal with the book, and then we'll talk about your path in those 50 years after. But how did you approach the 50th anniversary edition?
How did I approach it? I wanted to share my journey for sure, and I wanted to underscore how much more is at stake. As I begin the new chapter that opens the new book, I say that what was a really good choice in 1971 has become an absolute necessity for life on Earth. And that is not hyperbole, that is really true, that we are creating a food system that is destroying the whole species and destroying our own lives, that the diseases coming from the food we eat, we are killing ourselves by feeding ourselves, and that is not smart. So it's in many ways so much worse, and yet we know so much more about how to eat healthfully, and we have examples from all over the world of cultures moving toward a healthier relationship with the earth and their bodies of what they eat. So it's I wanted to communicate both the how much worse it is, how much more dire, how much more is at stake than when I wrote the first book, and how much more is emerging that shows us another pathway that is toward life itself.
Very good. I'm going to read another quote from you. You say, in a mighty storm, sometimes the biggest tree comes crashing down, and for the first time we can see its roots. Now is such a storm. So how do we grasp the roots and use what we discover to pull ourselves back from catastrophe and guide us toward life itself? And that seems to me to be, it's fairly poetic, but it seems to me to be really the driving sort of force of the 50th anniversary.
Absolutely. Thank you. Yes, that we are in that moment, you know, where I often call it moment of dissonance, where things just don't make sense. And, you know, we have a choice because it's just not holding together. We have to question the foundation. And so, as you have already said, for me, part of that foundation, the key to that is who has the power to make the choices, to move us forward instead of keeping us locked into this death trap. And that then brings us to what is democracy? What is democracy? Because democracy is, for me, the three conditions of the inclusive power, so all of us have a voice. It's transparency, so we know what's going on. You know, they're not hidden players, the corporate leaders behind the door. And that we have a culture that's not just pointing fingers, but where we're all know that if we're all connected, we're all implicated, both in the problem and in the solutions. Or my friend in Germany, the precious Hans-Peter Dürer, now deceased, unfortunately, but he once said, Frankie, in human and biological systems, there are no parts. They're only participants. So we can't just be finger pointing at the other. So these three conditions are what, to me, create this idea of democracy as a living journey, as a process. It's not that we've got a democracy and we're finished and we can just pat ourselves on the back. Actually, on that point, I was just checking, Terrence, that 85% of Americans think that, at least as of a couple of years ago, think that we are the greatest or one of the greatest democracies on Earth. And so we need to really go deep to challenge ourselves about democracy being defined by really who has voice and the degree of transparency and the degree that we all are feeling like we're responsible. And, you know, often the term responsibility, people react to like, oh, that's a burden. And I claim that is in the responsibility that our power and the thrill arises. What is responsibility? It's power. If somebody is responsible, then that means they have some power. So I just want to translate that into energy for change that is thrilling and rewrite this whole notion of democracy as a dull duty.
And also even, I mean, I think too often in America, and I just don't have enough experience elsewhere, people kind of define democracy as elections. And you'd think that even then, how could we grade ourselves so high since we have such poor participation in elections, but that's just compounds the error. But no, democracy, you point out it's William Hastie.
Yes.
Has that great quote about democracy is not being, it's becoming.
It is easily lost and never finally won. Its essence is eternal struggle.
Yeah.
And I love to point out that eternal struggle is what John Lewis, in his precious life, always called us to, the good struggle. It was always the what I now would think of as the thrill of democracy is what John Lewis stood for in my life. And so that's what William Hastie was talking about. So I really hope that people will find this new version of Diet for Small Planet as an invitation to engage at a richer, deeper level than before. And this is the moment. This is the moment for all, not just for our own country, but for the world, to make this shift that I'm talking about.
It's interesting, yes. In other words, 50 years ago, Diet for a Small Planet was essentially about changing your diet of what you ate. Now I think it's still an invitation to do that or to reinforce that or to, as I said, provide context and meaning to why you're doing that. But it's also to change the diet of how you participate in society.
Right, right. And also to understand that on the food system itself, it's not just about the waste. That's what I was leaning on, you know, 50 years ago, how wasteful it was. Now we know that the food system contributes 37% of all greenhouse gas emissions. And if cows were a country, they would be the sixth largest greenhouse gas emitter. So the climate question, but also species decimation. We've been told that we are on the edge of the sixth great extinction of life on Earth, and largely because of a meat-centered diet going global and therefore destroying rainforests that are so essential in the balance of our climate. So it's just so much more at stake. And also the use of chemicals. Now I see this estimate that half of all farmers, almost half, 44%, of farmers in the world are poisoned every year by pesticides. So it's the harms are multiple.
And then in wealthy societies, and growing more and more true in all societies, we also are killing ourselves. The substitute of processed food for actual food, the wages of that are you couldn't, I don't think in 71 you could have imagined it.
No. That this reality today that 60% of our calories that Americans eat come from ultra-processed foods, that's a code word for no nutrients. That's a code for a lot of calories, a lot of salt, sugar, but virtually nothing that's good for us. And so that is a national crisis that has led to the diabetes epidemic just exploding, a fourfold increase in the rate of diabetes. And I've learned also the WHO has now decided to name meat as a carcinogen in the sense of processed meat being a carcinogen and other types of beef probable carcinogen. And I just learned that recently. That's not even in the new chapter. But the idea that that we don't know that is pretty terrifying.
And let me just ask a quick question. I heard you say that last, I listened to a talk you gave, and I heard you say that. When you say processed, I assume that obviously means luncheon meats, but does it also mean all those little nuggets and things like that?
I wish I knew more. I assume a lot of that's hot dogs.
Yeah.
And salami, things that fall into that category, bologna, you know, salami, hot dogs. And I just feel like that's a message that's got to get out, because how many kids are eating those every day.
Every day. And listen, that's
Yeah.
I certainly remember that was my diet as a young. I can remember when I was working construction one summer and I'd eat like three bologna sandwiches for lunch.
Yeah.
I wanted to say just a couple of other things about democracy. And one is I interviewed Astra Taylor, who has written a book and produced a documentary on democracy. And she points out Plato's paradox that democracy will inevitably lead to tyranny, that the rich always want to get richer, and the poor will follow any demagogue who promises to overthrow the rich, which will lead to tyranny. And that the greatest, this is the key, the kicker, the greatest penalty for declining to rule is to be ruled by someone worse than yourself. And that goes back to that thing you were saying about responsibility.
Wow, yeah, I find that terrifying, and it doesn't ring true to me. I mean, I think that human beings, all of us, beyond the physical need for food, for example, that we have the deep need to, one, to feel like we're not powerless, to feel that we have agency, right? Second, to feel that our lives have meaning, and third, that we feel connected to others in common purpose. So power, meaning, and connection, those are not trivial needs. Those are deep human needs. And if they're not met through democratic society, then they are met through, a terrorist group or through some other demagogue. But if we can meet those needs genuinely, constructively through democracy, then we can continue to grow those the positives in human nature. I mean, part of my theory of our downfall is that we bought this idea of that fundamentally, if you peel away the layer, the veneer, that we are just selfish little shoppers. We're just that the free market, quote unquote, was made for us, so we can just go out and shop for our own satisfaction and forget about everything else. And I just really don't believe in that idea that there is this innate lack of goods and that is scarcity and goodness in terms of human nature. But if you start out with scarcity of both goods and goodness, then you do fall for this idea that we have to turn over our fate to some automatic force, and it's what Ronald Reagan called the magical market. So that it comes down, Terrence, to what we believe human beings are. And my idea is that we can be both very brutal toward one another and incredibly cooperative, and that depends on the rules that we set, whether they bring out the best or the worst in us. And that's
I so
it.
agree. Rutger Bregman's recent book, Humankind,
I love it.
looks at the the history and finds that that contention that we are naturally greedy, naturally selfish, all of that is really not borne out, and that it is very much more likely that we are naturally cooperative, that our social skills and our willingness to be socially cooperative is how we survived against much stronger, faster predators. I wanted you to repeat again because I think they're so. If people left here with a couple of things, one of them I would love people to remember is that you like your trilogies, you like your threes. And so and I know you've said both of these, but the three deepest human needs beyond the physical, and then the three premises for society to work.
Oh, thank you. I'd love to repeat that. Okay, so first of all, I totally agree with you about the Bregman book and about how we evolved as cooperators, and there's a lot of anthropology behind that. Now, so in our from our most primitive times, we evolved the need for a sense of power, that we have agency in life, number one. Number two, that our lives have meaning beyond just survival. And number three, that we are connected in community. We are social creatures. So those three are our deepest needs, and they can be expressed either positively or negatively, depending on the rules that we create. And the rules that have been proven to bring out the best in us are those that keep power widely distributed, so no one is powerless, that our social, our public relationships are transparent so that we know what's going on. That's essential. And third, that we cultivate a culture in which we teach the youngest and the eldest to understand that in society, no one is off the hook. We are all implicated. I say to people, wait, we can blame Bill Clinton for deregulating Wall Street and therefore letting out this disaster that led to the big crash. But we can also say, okay, where were we when we didn't call that out and stop it? We weren't up there as the active citizens that we needed to be to prevent that outrage. So it's easy to point fingers. And yes, some are guilty, as Rabbi Abraham Joshua Heschel put it. I love this. He said, some are guilty, all are responsible.
Yeah, that really struck me. And this is something that I find not only to end up saying on the air, but I end up sort of a little haunted by, you know, in my quiet moments, that to have been on the right side of losing arguments and losing movements and so on is like a consolation prize. I mean, the representation that we have is the representation we have. You and I are similar in age. Our time in power, if you will, has been a very mixed mixed results, and I think a great way to hold it is, as you say, some are guilty, all are responsible. Let me tell people, this is Free Forum, A World That Just Might Work. I'm Terrence McNally, speaking with Frances Moore LePay. She's just released her first book, The Game-Changing Diet for a Small Planet, in a 50th anniversary edition with a new introduction that really links that 50-year-old book to current conditions, current needs, and current possibilities, and has reached out to a number of our greatest chefs for a number of new recipes. And you can learn more about the book at Diet for a Small Planet, all one word, dietforasmallplanet.org, and about her democracy work, which, as you can tell, we are speaking a great deal about, because for her, they arise from the same needs and principles and so on. Her democracy work at democracymovement.us. I want to say something, a couple of other things about democracy. One is, first, I'm just going to, I interviewed Rebecca Henderson of Harvard Business School recently, and the renowned economist Branko Milanovic. What was interesting was that both of them pointed out a key flaw of what happens when shareholder value is the paramount goal of commerce and business and industry. And because they said it's pretty obvious that one of the most effective strategies to increase profit to shareholders is to overwhelm politics and government with money and write your own rules. And they said at that point, capitalism is truly corrupted. That once you are writing the rules by which you have to play, once if shareholder value is your only value, you will do that. That then the whole system breaks down. Let me throw that to you. I thought it was an excellent point of sort of going, that's a red line.
Yes, absolutely. And that's the red line we have crossed. And I want to underscore for everyone that our elections, the cost, the expenditures in our elections are just way out of line with any other industrial democracy. $14.4 billion at the last election. That was double the previous national election. 14.4 billion is compared in Germany. I know it's a much smaller country, but even if you do the proportional, it's a tiny fraction. It was like 110 million. It was in the, you know, it was a tiny, tiny fraction, even proportionally to population of what we spent. And that has to change. We have to remove the power of money in our elections. And I want to underscore here that it hasn't always been true. Back in the 70s, Jimmy Carter won running on largely on public financing. And that is something that can be returned, and it works in a lot of Western countries, that at least a good part of the funding for election, it comes from public funds, not private individuals who want to score, who want to have power, private power over the public purse. So I couldn't agree more that we've reached this point of this, the infection. And I also want to talk about lobbying, how that has changed. And of course, that's bringing in the power of private interest. That in the 70s, there were very few lobbyists in Washington, but before the 70s, the early 70s, but during the 70s up until the early 80s, there was a 14-fold increase in the firms that have lobbyists in Washington. And now, just in terms of the topic today, there are more agribusiness lobbyists than there are oil and gas lobbyists in Washington. There are 20 lobbyists there working for corporate interest for every one person that you and I elect to sit in Congress to defend our interests. We're outnumbered 20 to 1.
That is how wealth and the corporate world gets to set the rules by which they have to play, is through the use of those lobbyists and the overwhelming amount of money released into the system by Citizens United. One point that I don't think we can get into, but I want to mention, and then I want to talk about democracy from a different angle. Both you and I think, believe the people are not polarized. The parties are. The country is not polarized. The Beltway, D.C. is. Majorities favor so many progressive policies, and I read some recent findings of how majorities, including Republicans, favor most of the investments in the two infrastructure bills the Democrats are trying to pass right now. It is only in Washington, it is only among the parties that they are 50-50.
Yes, yes, yes. I did a blog recently. I think if you just Google my name and the word majority.
Oh, I got it.
Yeah.
And it's after issue, 80% favor limits right. on raising and spending in congressional campaigns. 80% this, 77% this. And if you read the commentators, if you watch the commentators, if you pay attention to Washington, you wouldn't know that.
No. Yeah, I'm so glad you brought that up, Terrence.
The other thing I want to talk about is that this all this money that we're spending on these elections, what we've gotten out of it is minority rule. And I just want to talk a little bit about that and then set you up. The Republican Party, I believe, its beliefs and its policies, while passionately held by millions, are no longer those of the majority of Americans. So the only way they can survive and actually dominate is to game the system. The U.S. holds only one national popular vote. That for president and vice president. The Republican Party has won that national vote only once since 1988, 32 years. There's only one national vote, and the Republican Party has won it once, yet they have held the presidency for 12 of those years. They have an equal number of senators, though they receive millions fewer votes than the Democrats in Senate elections. They dominate the Supreme Court and have appointed 5 Supreme Court justices in those 32 years, while Democratic presidents have appointed just 2. And I believe that sustained minority rule not only produces unpopular policies, but also weakens and sickens democracy, breeding cynicism, resignation, and the sorts of tribal divisions that we now face. Your thoughts about this minority rule phenomenon and the work you've done in democracy and the book that we've talked about in the past, Daring Democracy.
Oh, thank you for that. I'm so glad you laid those numbers out for us, because that is so, that has to sink in, that minority rule. And another piece of it that I would just like to add, that the culture of the idea of this mythical market that sorts out winners and losers, and that it's a fair market, it leads to a culture of blame and shame.
Yes.
And I think that the shaming, that people, when they feel shamed, rather than having those three needs met that I mentioned earlier, when they feel shame, then they want to point fingers at the other, and not with the whole system that has deprived them of their voice. But we tend to be very, our social nature has a downside as well as an upside. And part of our social nature is that we want to be part of a group. And if that means pointing a finger at somebody else, then we feel better because at least we're part of something. And so I really think that blaming and shaming that comes out of this false idea of a fair marketplace is something that we have to get better at. Just calling out and helping people understand that we can't blame and shame, but we have to change the system so that we all have opportunity. And so I couldn't agree more that this minority rule has got to be much more named, and its effects really clear to people. And one of the things I'm going to be doing with the rest of my life is how to make that more visible and more, and not sort of, I think you and my sense of you, Terrence, is that you try the both and, that on the one hand to shock people with how deeply rooted the problem, how severe it is, at the same time not discourage them from the joy, the thrill of being part of the solution. And that's really, I want to come back to our website, democracymovement.us, that came out of my 2016 march. For me, it came out of the Democracy Spring March from Philadelphia to Washington, D.C., and sitting in on the Capitol steps and realizing that I was not alone, that there is this rising democracy movement. And our partner in creating that website, democracymovement.us, I just want to point out that their organizational membership includes, if you take all the members of the 60 plus organization, it comes to something like 45 million Americans. And somebody was just pointing out to me that 45 million is the number that often has been used by to cite what the narrow right wing point of view is.
Right.
Something like that, same size.
That base. Yeah.
That base. And so we can overlook the fact that already these engaged people who are already part of organizations working for democracy, but we're less visible. It's really, we've got to make it more visible that this is something that's not a dull duty. This is a thrilling experience to be part of a vibrant democracy movement that is going to the very roots of the problem.
Yeah. I'm going to give a couple of references, actually, to what you were talking about in terms of shame. You say, I think shame is one of the most difficult emotions for people to cope with, and the only tool seems to be to blame others. Two books that really deal in this shame that I recommend. One is Tightrope by Nick Kristoff and Cheryl Wu Dunn, in which they kind of find so many people feel bad that they were not able to bring themselves up by their bootstraps, when of course it is physically impossible to do so, especially when you don't even have bootstraps, as is the case with so many of them. And the other book is a book that is less well known, called A Shame Game by Mary O'Hara. I don't know if you know it, but Mary is a writer for The Guardian. She grew up in extreme poverty in Northern Ireland, and her book is all about that and what it feels like to be ashamed of your circumstances as if it is always your fault. Before we end, we've got about 8 more minutes. I want you to talk about some of the actions and movements in other countries, many in the Global South, that give you hope.
Oh, thank you. And I will read those books. I'm very grateful for that. Inspiring me right now is one generalization. I'll start with that and then I'll tell a little story that's so meaningful to me. But there is a professor at the University of Essex in the UK, Jules Preti, and he's made a life's work out of tracking the emergence of democratic social groups in the global south. He long focused on Africa and now, with his team, has looked the entire world. And Dr. Preti and his team, they have documented that over just a 20-year period, they looked at the year 2000 and then to the year 2020. They said at the year 2000, there were about 500,000 worldwide of these local groups that were working for sustainable farming in a cooperative way and making a difference. Well, they went back and they studied over the next 20 years and found 8 million more such groups had emerged just in that 20-year period. So, part of that, I assume, are groups that I have had personal contact with, and I just found that burgeoning number so thrilling. But to tell you a personal story, I
Yes.
visited not too far from Hyderabad in India. And I got to visit with a group of women who are part of a 75 village network called the Deccan Development Society. And these are villages and where women have come together as leaders. Now, remember, I'm talking about a very sexist society, and these women are also Dalit, meaning that they're lower caste women. So they came, arose to adulthood feeling pretty powerless relative to their husbands, relative to village government, and certainly to state and federal. But they started meeting 20, 30 years ago. This Deccan Development Society began with just handfuls of women meeting at night in their villages and coming to decisions about what they could do together, including very small lending circles. So they'd put in a few, a rupee or so, and then they would get enough that somebody could rent a piece of land or even own a piece of land, even small. And they started growing healthy, multiple crops that were helping each other, by their diversity with legumes growing to help fertilize the other grains and vegetables. And over this time, they completely eradicated hunger in their villages, and they even petitioned to get a radio station, so they have their own radio station telling other villagers how they did this. And they've now spoken at international meetings about their accomplishments, and their food is part of the school lunch program now in their state. Now, these were the lowest caste, most powerless women who are making this transformation. And as I went to talk to them and sat in their, I still remember vividly sitting on the grass woven mat, and with each they had little piles of little delicate piles of grain in front of them, showing me all their different seeds. And they told me their story from utter powerlessness to the end of hunger in our village. No one is hungry in our village, they said. And so I was just so moved, and I got up and said, thank you, thank you, thank you. And I started moving back to leave the village and walk away. And suddenly I heard this rush behind me. And I turned around, and the women were running after me and saying, wait, we forgot to tell you the most important thing. And they said, what we forgot to tell you is that the most important thing of our women's group was that we found our courage. Courage is the most important. And so I end my new chapter, and more I talk about courage, because courage is what this time needs. Because to do what the earth and humanity needs of us is causes our hearts to pound, in that terror of doing something different, doing something we haven't done. And so I have this corny little trick I do for myself when I feel that pounding heart. I say, oh, that's my inner applause saying, go for it, Frankie. But I really think, and I really want to end on this note, that humans are good enough. We don't have to be better in that sense as a species, but we have to find our courage. And our social nature is that double edge, because we're so social, it's so hard to break from the pack. But our pack is kind of heading right over the falls, and we don't want to stay with that pack. We don't want to go over the falls. So we've got to break from the dominant pack and say the unpopular and do things we've never done before. And so I end up saying that the way, because we are so social, the way to find more courage is to hang out with courage. Mm-hmm. Find people who are doing more risky, gutsy things than you've ever done, and make friends with them, be buddies with them, and you'll get that bug. And they'll be there to catch you if you fall too, right? Figuratively or literally. And so I just want to embrace that part of ourselves, that to change ourselves, we have to choose our companions well. Choose those who challenge us, not just dig us into where we're stuck.
And you were asked in one of the interviews I read, what you hoped people took from this 50th edition. And you said the first word that comes to mind is power. That's agency. But I think what you're also saying is power and community. And then I want to read a couple of quotes from you as to how Diet for a Small Planet changed you, and how changing your diet changed you, because I think it links to this. You said, our personal acts are a daily affirmation of our connection with the earth, with others' fates, and with living our values. The more we align our lives with the world we want, the more convincing we are to ourselves and by extension to others. I've always thought that my individual choices are part of changing the rules that create hunger out of plenty and that are destroying ecosystems. I know that my actions alone is not going to change the world, but it changes me. I'll give you one more last word to follow up that.
Well, I believe it more than ever in this now 50-year journey. And I just hope that other people find this approach giving them more energy. I believe that we don't have to be optimists. I think that's very hard right now. I call myself a possibilist, because I think all human beings need is this possibility, to feel that the possibility that their actions can make a difference, and they'll go for it, and we will go for it. So I love this idea that it's not possible to know what's possible, and therefore we are free to go for the world we want.
Thank you. So again, the book is Diet for a Small Planet in a 50th anniversary edition with a new introduction and new recipes. You can learn more about the book at dietforasmallplanet.org and more about democracy work at democracymovement.us. For this conversation and many other interviews and articles, to join me in pursuit of a world that just might work, go to terrencemcnally.net, terrencemcnally.net, or aworldthatjustmightwork.com. They're the same website. If you want to receive my weekly email announcement telling you who's going to be on, what we're going to talk about, and usually 10 articles to flesh out the conversation, sign up at my site or email me at temcnally@mac.com. You can also subscribe and listen to the free forum podcast on Apple Podcasts and most podcast sites. You can find years of podcasts out there at my site or at most of these other sites. Michael Lewis, Jeremy Scahill, Naomi Klein, Robert Reich, Van Jones, Connie Rice, Greg Boyle. You can also follow me on Twitter at McNally Terrence. Thanks to George Vassilopoulos at Progressive Voices, and most of all, you, my listeners. Please share this podcast widely. And finally, thank you, Francis Moore-LaPay. Keep up the good work.
Thank you.